Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Kimberly Atkins-Store, Jill Wine-Banks, Barb McQuaid, and me, Joyce Vance. In today's show, we'll discuss new developments in DOJ's prosecution of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Trump's newest scam to make money off the presidency using Truth Social and selling early access to his posts, and another loss in court for the Trump administration, this time in a lawsuit alleging Harvard was engaging in anti-Semitism. But before we get to the serious stuff, summer is almost over. There's a couple of more weeks. Y'all, have you taken up any new hobbies or done any new outdoor activities this summer while we're still living with it?
Well, I haven't taken up any new hobbies, but in the summer, I play tennis and occasional round of golf. And, I'm always looking for that elusive, perfect forehand. So I practice, but I have a really nice group of friends that I play tennis with. And so it's always enjoyable, even when my shots are going into the net or way long out of bounds.
Well, as y'all can see on video, this is our younger German Shepherd. Our older German Shepherd has had a traumatic medical week and is recovering, but recovery's along the way. This one, Elsa, who I hope won't show up too much during the episode, has taught me to throw her ball constantly. So I'll be sitting at my desk throwing the ball for her all day, which means I now have a great throwing arm. What about you, Kim? Any new activities this summer?
Well, the one thing I can think of is I've been lucky enough to be on the coast quite a bit over the summer, and I love the beach and I love being in the water. And traditionally, I sort of splash around in it. But this year, after being inspired by people who I see like legit swimming, you know, parallel to the shore, I've been trying that a little bit. And I think I'm improving my swimming skills a bit in doing that. It's actually kind of funny. When I did it, I was on Martha's Vineyard last week, and I was doing it a bit. And so I picked a point. I found where my towel was on shore, right? And so I'm like, all right, I'm going to swim and see how far I can go. So I'm swimming, and I look to my side, and the towel is still right there. And I swim, and I swim some more, and I look, and there's my towel. I'm like, what the heck is going on? Like, it's hard when you have the current going in a certain way. So then I turned around, and I started swimming the other way, and boom, I'm at the jetty, like way down. And I'm like, okay, well, how do I get back? Do I get out and walk back to my towel, or do I try to swim? Because I will never get there.
It's like a swimming treadmill.
It is. Yeah, it really
you got
is.
Off of the vineyard before the sharks started showing up, man. There have been shark sightings like every day lately.
Well, I was a target for a long time that I was basically standing still off the shore of Oak Bluffs.
Jill, what about you? What have you been up to?
So like Kim, I'm not doing anything really new, but pursuing all the things I always do in the summer, which is taking long walks and swimming, which I only really learned to swim the year we lived in Florida, which was in 1990. And my husband.
Is this a new Jill thing? I don't think I ever knew you lived in Florida.
I don't think any of you were Floridian.
Oh, well, I lived there for a year. My husband moved his business there, and I was going to join a law firm there and was about to study for the bar exam when I realized that Michael really wasn't going to enjoy his business in Florida. He needed to come back to Chicago. So I had the best year of networking and just meeting people. And I was on the board of one company that kept me at least earning some money while I was there because I couldn't practice law because I wasn't a member of the Florida Bar. But yeah, I lived in Florida for a year and it was really, really fun. Made some great lifetime friends. Yeah, it was wonderful. But I did really learn to swim that year because the house we rented had a pool, and my husband was a college swimmer, high school and college swimmer. And so he really taught me to swim. So that was a good thing. But we've been kayaking as well, and I know you've taken up kayaking, so that's a lot of fun. But we're also trying to go to more theater where it's nice and cool to stay away from the weather, but also because it's the theater in Chicago is so exciting and wonderful. We have everything from Shakespeare to the most modern things, and we have great local theaters. So I'm doing a lot of that this summer.
There's nothing better than owning a home. It's your sanctuary. Until something breaks. Things can be going well for years, and suddenly the power is on the fritz, or a pipe bursts and starts creating the indoor pool that you never really wanted. It can be a total disaster where you don't know who to call or what to do. And there's nothing worse than not knowing how much it will cost to get back to normal life.
On the fritz. That's such an interesting phrase, isn't it? My dad always
yeah.
said that.
Oh, yeah. Maybe it's a Midwestern-y thing because I grew up saying that too.
Well, it can be challenging, especially because regular homeowners insurance usually doesn't cover a lot of the day-to-day wear and tear, like plumbing failures, HVAC breakdowns, or electrical issues. You're usually on your own for those. That's where HomeServe comes in. It's like a subscription for your home. For as little as $4.99 a month, they've got your back. Repairs hit fast and hard, but don't stress out during a panic search for a reliable contractor. Instead, you could already be on the phone with HomeServe's 24/7 hotline, scheduling a repair.
It's super simple. Choose a plan for your needs and budget, and when something on your plan goes wrong, just call their 24/7 hotline to start the repair process. It gives you such peace of mind. HomeServe can really help with your home ownership challenges. And now, thanks to one of their customized plans, if the water heater goes out or a faulty switch takes out power to your home office, you can call them first. You don't have to worry about being out of action. Skip the initial shock and start getting things fixed right away.
HomeServe has helped homeowners like you for over 20 years with a trusted national network of 2,600 local contractors. With nearly 4.5 million customers, a 4.8 out of 5 post-repair rating, and an A+ BBB rating. They're the real deal, so don't wait. Join the millions of customers who trust HomeServe for 50% less for your first year. Go to homeserve.com/sisters. That's homeserve.com/sisters for 50% less savings are compared to the renewal price voided in Florida. The link is in our show notes.
Well, I'm joining my sisters today from the corner of my daughter's bedroom in her brand new apartment in the big city. So please forgive the hostage video appearance of my background. But I want to talk about something that happened in a case this week, some new developments in the fraud case against the Southern Poverty Law Center. We discussed this case back in April when the charges were first filed. Joyce, can you please remind our listeners who the Southern Poverty Law Center is and why some critics have accused the Department of Justice of targeting it for political reasons?
Yeah, so the Southern Poverty Law Center, a civil rights group in Montgomery, Alabama, they've been around since the early 1970s. And they became prominent through litigation that essentially forced the Ku Klux Klan to fold. More recently, they're well known for the work that they do, tracking hate groups and tracking other extremist groups. And that's maybe what's brought them into the Justice Department's eye, because they have certainly targeted hate groups, whether it was the Unite the Right group that led the rally in Charlottesville, Virginia during Trump's first term. But more recently, the focus has been on the white supremacist groups that SPLC tracks and designates as extremist groups. So all of that, I think, makes it self-explanatory why this administration might be interested in going after them.
Yeah. And Jill, can you please explain the charges as they existed before this week? What was the government's theory of the case?
Well, there were actually two indictments before this week, which is the third, the second superseding. But let's go back to the original one from last April. And it focused on accusing the Southern Poverty Law Center of misleading banks and donors and using the money that donors gave them for purposes that weren't disclosed. And they have an informant program where they hire people to be informants on these hate groups. And of course, you have to hire somebody who's a member of that group to get information about that group. And so that's what they were accused of, was using money to pay informants, and that that money was then used to actually support the hate groups itself. That was the basic, I would say, outline of the original indictment.
And Kim, this week we saw new charges, adding a co-defendant. What are the new charges about?
Yes. So a new co-defendant, a person, was added to in this new superseding indictment. So Heidi Beerich, who was the person at the Southern Poverty Law Center who was in charge of paying these informants who went inside of these white supremacist groups, was arrested in California, as I said, in a superseding indictment, and she herself is also facing fraud charges. Basically, the theory of the case against her is that she was the one who facilitated these payments, so she was doing an action that led to this fraud. And also, one of the informants who was paid was also someone who she was living with at the time. And the indictment claims that the money that this person owned went into a bank account that was jointly owned by her and this person. I think the implication is that she herself was making money off of this practice of the Southern Poverty Law Center paying informants. And I know we're going to get into this a little bit more, but I just can't underscore enough that there is nothing wrong with an organization seeking to bring light and try to understand these groups doing things like using informants to get information from the inside. In fact, this is something that the FBI itself used to do. I have friends who used to work at the FBI office who actually did infiltrate white supremacist groups in the 90s and early 2000s. That was literally their job that they were paid to do by the government. So it's really interesting that the government is making a case that this is somehow fraud.
Yeah, you know, I agree with everything you said, Kim, especially about the prior indictment. I do wonder about these new charges against Heidi Beerich with the allegation that she was making payments to an informant and sharing a bank account with him. And that, you know, I'm always a little cautious about, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And,
yes.
And that suggests at least a conflict of interest.
Yes.
And so, Joyce,
what
do you think?
Yes, a conflict of interest at the least and self-dealing at the most, I think, is what that indictment is getting at.
This does look a little different to me. Joyce, what do you think? Do you think these charges are more meaningful than the prior charges, or do you think this is just more the same?
You know, I'm withholding judgment until we learn whether the government has the evidence to back up the allegations, because this is a Justice Department that's been far too quick to leap before it actually looks. Heidi is a well-known quantity in the civil rights community. She was an outstanding leader at SPLC. Her tenure was unblemished. So, you know, like you say, if they can prove it, let's see what's behind it. But we know that Southern Poverty Law Center had a lot of concerns about ensuring that these transactions were blind, so that none of their informants' personal safety was ever compromised. And, you know, what I would attribute this amendment to is the fact that DOJ took so much grief for indicting only the SPLC, but no individuals, when the indictment itself was full of allegations about individual misconduct. So I think that this indictment is actually an effort to make the case more palatable to a jury. You know, the trial date was, I think, set in October. I don't know if this will move that trial date back at all. I would suspect that it certainly will. Yeah. And so lots of unanswered questions here.
Yeah, it's very interesting in that if these allegations are true, that Heidi Beerich was sort of paying herself out of funds that belong to the Southern Poverty Law Center, then it's actually the Southern Poverty Law Center that's the victim here, right? That she's taking funds that donors sent to them for the purpose of using this informant program, and then she put them in her own bank account. Now, it may be that she put them in the bank. She paid this informant. They share a bank account. But as I said, that conflict of interest makes me a little bit uncomfortable. Jill, this is the second superseding indictment in the case. Can you just explain what a superseding indictment is and why we might get new charges against a new defendant months after the first indictment is filed? How does that work?
A superseding indictment is exactly self-explanatory. It is a indictment that succeeds the original one. So there's an indictment. And then, as is not unusual, prosecutors continue to investigate. In Watergate, we indicted in March, continued to subpoena records and interview witnesses, and we got significant information that changed how we proceeded in the case. So it is not unusual to continue an investigation and to supersede an indictment with a new one. I do want to say that in this case, we have to remember that the FBI was actually a beneficiary of some of the information. The Southern Poverty Law Center was communicating with the FBI, and indictments resulted of various people who were informed on because the informants from the Southern Poverty Law Center gave information to the FBI. So it really does change how you perceive what was going on. And yes, the new defendant shared a bank account, but the money that was paid was for his work as an informant. And so I'm a little less skeptical of the conflict of interest and whether she did anything particularly wrong. Part of it will depend on whether the organization knew she was living with the informant. So I think there are, as Joyce said, we will withhold judgment until we know all the facts. But I just want to say there's a possible exculpatory explanation for it.
Yeah, Kim, what about you? Do you put this case in the same basket with some of the other politically charged cases we've seen, like, you know, Jim Comey's seashells or Letitia James's baseless charges for mortgage fraud? Or do you think the new charges suggest that there's a legitimate basis for these charges? You know, for example, one of the allegations is that these funds that she paid to this informant with whom she was living were used for their mutual household living expenses.
Mm-hmm. So I think both things can be true in a way. I do think that it was a politically motivated investigation because Southern Poverty Law Center has gone after groups which unfortunately are part of the base of the Republican Party, including some that have been classified as hate groups or individuals who have been classified as those who foment hate or who could potentially do things that threaten the safety of Americans, but in so doing may have come across something that may or may not be nefarious. I think of a similar situation with the investigation into Act Blue, for example, which is the Democratic fundraising group that I think they were probably targeted for ideological reasons. But at the same time, it was uncovered that they did maybe didn't do as good a job as they should have done vetting their donors to ensure that no foreign donations were going into campaigns. Both things can be true. So again, that the jury is out as to the actual what actual evidence is presented in these crimes that could result in some sort of there. But I don't think that the two things are mutually exclusive.
Yeah, that's such a good point. You know, I can think of so many cases that we began to investigate and then we found some weird cover up along the way that we thought meant that somebody was obstructing the investigation, that they were involved in fraud. And so often it was because they were involved in some inappropriate romantic relationship. It's amazing how often that comes out. So kids, you know, just follow the rules. One relationship at a time. Got to be above board.
Avoid
and all this
conflict.
Stuff.
Avoid conflict, even if you always, think that it doesn't
matter. It always
matter.
Ends badly.
Yes.
This episode of Hashtag Sisters-in-Law is brought to you by our friends at Wild Grain. Wild Grain delivers sourdough breads, seasonal pastries, and French butter, yum, right to your door, all made by small independent bakeries. Everything bakes straight from frozen in 25 minutes or less. They are speaking my language. So you can enjoy freshly baked favorites whenever you want them. And unlike many grocery store options, Wild Grain uses simple, recognizable ingredients and a slow fermentation process, which is often easier to digest.
We love that you can customize your box with classic, gluten-free, vegan, and protein options. No matter what you choose, it's great how fast Wild Grain goes from the box to our table. And it's always a treat. I enjoyed a croissant this morning, although Kim may have to say it for me since my accent's not so good, but the taste was fantastic. The ingredients are so much better for you than the products that you find at the store. And my husband and I enjoy all of the breads, pastas, and pastries, and so do our guests. My guests are always surprised and impressed when I tell them that it's baked from frozen, not homemade. They often end up subscribing because it's perfect for delicious meals, snacks, or for quick food prep.
You know, it really is good, Jill. We've talked about this before, but having Wild Grain delivered is so convenient when life gets busy, but you still want to eat really first-rate bakery goods at home. Something that I have been really appreciative of this past week is watching the color and flavor come alive when the vegan maple Belgian waffles are heating up. It's a mouthful to say the name. They're absolutely fabulous. Then there's the slow churn French truffle butter. It's such a keeper. We've all raved about that. It comes with your order. You stick it in the fridge. I slather it on bread and baguettes. After a long day, the chocolate truffles are the perfect treat. They're gorgeous. The chocolate is smooth and rich. You just have to make sure you have enough to share with you. So when you want to treat your loved ones, Wild Grain is the perfect go-to.
If you're looking for an easy way to enjoy bakery quality bread at home, we definitely recommend giving Wild Grain a try. Wild Grain has more than 40,000 five-star reviews and was named USA Today's Best Food Subscription Box 3 years in a row. Plus, they have award-winning croissants. Visit wildgrain.com/sisters to get $30 off your first box, plus free croissant for life. Again, that's wildgrain.com/sisters for $30 off your first box and free croissant for life. Or use promo code SISTERS. The link is in our show notes. Well, because he's never one to give up an opportunity for the grift, President Trump announced that he is now allowing people to sign up for subscriptions to get early access to his Truth Social posts. In a new service called Truth API, I think the I in that stands for insider trading, maybe, for the cool cost of $100,000, people, let's say maybe, financial firms or what do you call those things you can bet on everything? Prediction markets. Prediction markets can get an early jump in order to profit off of things that the president may announce that could move markets. Now, again, where I came from, the law school I went to, that sort of made it sound like insider trading. But who knows? But there may be even other legal problems with this based on a new lawsuit that was filed this week. So, Barb, let's start there. Some media companies have gone to court claiming that Truth API is unconstitutional. They're making a novel claim here. Tell us about it and what you think of it.
Yeah. So, you know, in the absence of what we would normally expect, which would be an SEC investigation, but of course, the SEC is controlled by the Trump administration, we've instead seen some private litigants file a lawsuit in a pretty interesting case. So one is the Freedom of Press Foundation, which tracks some of Trump's posts on social media, and The Intercept, which is kind of a muckraking journalist outlet. But together, they sued the Trump administration for violations of the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, which is kind of interesting. So, first, it's, as you said, it's called Trump API, which stands for Application Programming Interface. My daughter explained this to me. She works in the AI field. And she said it's a software that allows two different applications to talk to each other. And so these subscribers would get these advance notices. If they had a $100,000 per month subscription, they could get advance notice of Trump's Truth Social posts, the marketing materials say they are market moving posts. But the First Amendment theory is that Americans have equal access to a president's public announcements. And by charging a fee for those announcements, it is burdening other plaintiffs like these press outlets. If they want to have access to the same information that other people have access to, they have to pay $100,000. They say they're not willing or able to do that, and it's a violation of their First Amendment rights. So that's one theory. The other is that this is a violation of their Fifth Amendment rights, and it's based on the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment. This is taking me way back to law school. Now, yep. The Fifth Amendment is full of lots of clauses, right? Like when you plead the Fifth, where you don't have to answer questions that might incriminate yourself. This one is the Takings Clause, which says that nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And so this is the one that's kind of a novel theory. What they say is the Fifth Amendment prohibits the government from imposing extortionate or unreasonable conditions on the availability of government information that's unrelated to the cost of providing that information. So in other words, we all have a right to this information for free. And when they make us pay for it, they're essentially doing a taking of our private property for public use without just compensation. So that's a pretty creative one. It might be crazy enough to work, but I think at the very least, this First Amendment theory is very sound. Just as we saw when Trump was using Twitter for public announcements, that was considered a public forum and that people had equal access to that information. I think that theory will be strong. And, you know, this Fifth Amendment theory will be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think that it will, too. It's amazing how much this administration has caused courts and litigants to think of whole areas of law in different ways than we ever thought we needed to think about it. But this is really interesting. So, Jill, as Barb pointed out, there are laws in place that, generally prohibit things that may be insider trading. One law that I can think of off the top of my head is the Stock Act, which was passed in order to prevent lawmakers, members of Congress, from being able to trade on information that they get from information that they know from their lawmaking activities that the general public may not know to keep them honest. I remember when I first started covering Congress here in Washington, that bill was being heavily debated and got some bipartisan support. But I think most people don't realize that it also applies to the president and vice president, too, that they're not allowed to use information that they get from their positions in order to, line their pockets. So do you think, though, that Trump will face any repercussions under that law if what he's doing is in fact illegal?
Well, has he faced any consequences to any of his illegal conduct? No, he hasn't. So it's a question of right now, because the Department of Justice, of course, would not prosecute him. There's no way that anything's going to happen. And because Congress is not bipartisan, Congress isn't going to do anything either. But the statute of limitations doesn't run if he's not in office in two more years. This certainly could be a lawsuit that a new administration would bring. So there could be consequences. The Stock Act was passed in, I think, 2012. It was under Obama. And it should apply here because this is, first of all, you have to say grift is grift, but $100,000 a month?
Yeah.
I mean, this is like in a whole different category of grift. If he was charging $100,000 forever and for always, maybe that's one thing. But he's advertising that it is for early access to market-moving information.
He's giving it away. Like he's not just saying, just early access to, the food I'm cooking. No, he's saying out loud what it is.
Exactly. So it's like he's confessed to the crime. I don't know how else you could say this would be definitely admissible against him because he publicly said it. So I think it's clearly a crime. I think the First Amendment is very strong. My law school classmate, Judge Buchwald, issued a First Amendment decision in 2018 in the Twitter case, saying it's a public forum. The president is using this to announce government business, and so everyone has to have access to it. You cannot
block people from having it. Not just you can't charge people and then keep other people away. So I think this is a clear violation of everything.
Yeah, I do too. And on the media front, you know, as a journalist, I really don't like the idea of this. If it's upheld, I worry that some media organizations will choose to pay to do this to get the scoop on things, especially those that are very scoop driven, the same way that a lot of media organizations, in a way that I don't support, are joining in partnerships with these prediction market companies in order to get their data from that. That feels really, that feels sketch to me. I would not want to be beholden to these, the data in these prediction markets, given that a lot of people are involved in that have financial incentive to create certain amounts of data. I can't trust that it's even accurate. And not to mention all of the money that's being made off of it. And I think if you start pushing media companies into that game, that would be really, really bad. So Joyce, Congress is also probing the matter. What are some lawmakers doing and what more could they do theoretically, keeping in mind that they're controlled by Republicans right now?
Well, you know, I guess you're talking about what would the world look like if Congress had a spawn, which is just an endless party game in my house right now. Hey, Kim, I don't, to the point you were just making, I don't know if you saw this reporting that said that there were already 10 entities that had signed up for Trump's $100,000 a month pop. I don't know who they are, but I mean, that's $1 million a month.
And well, it might be a little less. The reporting that I saw was that it was unclear if all 10 of them paid the full $100,000, which kind of tells you how valuable they may think this is. They may be giving it out on a discount to some people.
Well, I mean, isn't there the possibility that this is just more pay to play, right? You've got to pay the $100,000. I mean, there's just so much grift here. Jill, what was it you said? Like, you said something really great just now, and the words have flown out of my mind, but it was like, everything is illegal or something. Which is just the most true thing ever here. Yeah. And so, yes, no surprise that all of the action that we're seeing in Congress is led by Democrats. I mean, Mark Warner, the Virginia senator, introduces the most direct action, right? He introduces a new law called the No Profit Act. And it just says, this is illegal. You can't do what Trump is doing here. He owns Truth Social. He benefits financially from all of this stuff. So that, I think, is a direct action. And as you point out, Kim, we will see no movement on that until after the midterms, when hopefully the Senate will be in a position to kick that one off. Elizabeth Warren and Adam Schiff have reached out to the SEC to call for an investigation. And of course, that's unlikely to happen while Donald Trump is in office. But as a prosecutor, I think that that's important. I think that puts down a marker. To Jill's point about the statute of limitations being 5 years and continuing to run after Trump is out of office, you know, I bet you Trump is sitting on a hip pocket opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel that says that what he's doing is an official act and that that would bring it within the scope of immunity. And so somebody is going to have to take this to the Supreme Court if there's ever a prosecution and try to get the court to update what they said in that case so that it's not like any time the president says it's an official act, it is. When Donald Trump is making a personal profit using public information, that does not somehow become the official act of a public official. And maybe this is where that dam breaks. I think for my money, the most interesting thing that's happening in Congress right now is that Jamie Raskin, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, is using his position to open a House investigation. And although he's constrained, he can't, for instance, issue subpoenas without the permission of the majority. He's setting it up. He's getting the ball rolling. This takes some time. Come January, I would say that Congressman Raskin will be ready to rock and roll on this, and we will update y'all when that happens.
Of course, so Joyce, if it is, in fact, a official act, isn't that more proof that the First Amendment is violated?
You know, these things cut all different ways, Jill, right?
Yeah.
And I think you make this great argument that as Trump tries to use these novel paths for grift, he exposes himself in other areas. I think you're dead on the money.
Yeah. And, you know, I just think that it's really interesting because clearly this is a grift. He's proven himself to be very greedy, already profiting $2 billion since returning to office. I think it's also one thing that I think is funny. I think it's also evidence of how poorly Truth Social is doing. Yeah. It's lost a ton of money since going public. People don't care anymore. The things that he tweet, like he's again tweeting as of this recording that the Strait of Hormuz is open. Oh. Nobody believes him. Nobody cares. Nobody's paying attention. I think not even his supporters care about it so much. So I think he's trying to do anything he can as ad revenue drops to make money. But again, it's a tell. From the grift itself is a tell as to what a terrible product it is. So maybe that's why maybe reportedly, allegedly, he had to give some people discounts. Just saying. Now that summer is here, we're all more active and spending more time outdoors, which means we need to make sure our outfits meet the demands of the moment. But each year, it seems like it's harder to find shapewear and foundational garments that don't chafe, stab, or suffocate you, particularly when it gets very humid like it does here in DC. Comfort, style, and support are a must. And the last thing you want to do is to keep readjusting your fit when you have things to do and places to go. But luckily, we found options that work with your body and fit perfectly in all the right places, from our favorite independent female-founded brand called Honey Love. Their founder, Betsy, leads a team of women who bring their talent and experience to design every product with your body and needs in mind. And the results are incredible.
With other brands, it seems like there's always something poking you or that needs adjusting. You might think that the only way to get shape and support is with sharpened wires and couch-sized padding. Luckily, you don't have to put up with that. You can look fashionable and get form and function without it. For instance, there's Honey Love's Cloud Embrace Bra. It's soft, breathable, and incredibly comfortable, but still supportive enough to replace your old underwires. And it feels so great to wear that from the moment you put it on, you don't have to think about it again for the entire day.
Even if you're a longtime Honey Love fan, like all of us are, they are always releasing exciting new pieces you'll want to add to your collection. And I love how everything stays in place and moves with you. Recently, they launched the new Crossover Contour Bra, which features their best-selling wireless crossover design with a beautiful contoured shape and built-in molded light foam pads for when you start to need extra structure or support. It's not about changing your body. It's about supporting it in a way that matches the occasion and actually feels good. And Honey Love delivers at every stage.
Honey Love has so many other things to offer. They've built a full line of tanks, bodysuits, shapewear, and foundational items featuring supportive structure, smoothing fabrics, and premium finishes made for any occasion. As you get more experienced, comfort isn't a luxury. It's a requirement. Experienced. I like the way you said that there. You need to check them out. Treat yourself to the most advanced shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honey Love at honeylove.com/sisters. That's honeylove.com/sisters. After you check out, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honey Love. The link is in the show notes.
Well, here's another case that's been dismissed. This time, it's a case that the Department of Justice brought against Harvard. I can't say it the way Bostonian.
Thank you. Harvard. Pakistan, Harvard,
for me also, please. Anyway, it's been dismissed because there was really no evidence of a continuing action of anti-Semitism by Harvard. So, Joyce, let's start with that, and let's look at what anti-Semitic acts did DOJ allege against Harvard or Harvard?
Yeah, I mean, this was principally, it was a deliberate indifference selective enforcement case. And so the allegations were that students and others allegedly created a hostile environment for Jewish students and Israeli students, people of that national origin, and that Harvard knew about it, but they failed to enforce neutral campus rules that they would have enforced if it had been anybody else. So tons of allegations of specific situations. Some of them include, for instance, a protest that was taking place at a library where only Jewish and Israeli students were blocked from accessing the facility that was open to other Harvard students. Or another incident where an Israeli student who was filming a protest was allegedly assaulted. And the school really didn't take it very seriously. In fact, ended up giving a graduate stipend to one of the men who was alleged to have been involved. So there's a whole laundry list of factual allegations like that in the government's case.
Yeah, there was even things like one student was forced to wear a baseball cap over his yarmulke so that he wouldn't be identified as Jewish. But Barb, okay, so these were allegations. What law was supposedly violated by Harvard's action or inaction, failure to act?
Well, the lawsuit had essentially two claims. One was a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You know, this was the massive Civil Rights Act signed by Lyndon Johnson that's got lots of different components to it. And one of those is Title VI, which says that no person in the United States shall be discriminated against on the ground of race, color, or national origin under any program receiving federal funds. And the lawsuit, as Joyce described, argued that Harvard was either deliberately indifferent or intentionally allowing harassment against Jewish students in violation of Title VI. That was one claim. The other was a fairly simple breach of contract claim. Yeah. It said that as a condition of accepting federal funds, Harvard had agreed not to discriminate against students based on race, color, or national origin, and that by allowing the harassing of Jewish students, they had violated that contractual promise.
And Kim, the judge has already ruled on this now. Explain and analyze his ruling that this case should be dismissed.
Yeah, so the ruling, it's really great. It's only a cut, was it 1, 2, 3, 4 pages long. It's a quick read if you want to take a look at it yourself. And what it does is it dismisses the case on what we civil attorneys call a 12B6 motion. And what that is that's at a very early case. That's after the complaint was made. Basically, if a party moves to have the whole matter dismissed because the government failed to state a claim, which means that they have not the facts as they stand in the complaint, if there is evidence to prove all of those things were true, then if that case went to court, it couldn't win. So it's like an early and like definitive dismissal that this case is really, really bad. It's very rare to get a 12B6 dismissal. You usually lose on summary judgment. It's extremely rare. And the fact that Judge Stearns did it and did it so quickly. It is really remarkable. He basically said that the three instances that were cited in the government's complaint, and I will quote from him in a minute, that even if all those things happened, it was not enough to rise to the level of a violation of Title VI or a breach of contract. He writes, without diminishing any concern arising from these occurrences, the court finds them singly and collectively to be too isolated and episodic to support a plausible inference that any institutionalized noncompliance with Title VI persists at Harvard to this day. And the government, he puts a finer point on it, kind of noting that the government went from claiming that these three instances alone constituted a violation to alleged that they believe that the violation is ongoing. He went on to say, as noted above, the amended complaint is devoid of any factual allegations plausibly establishing that any events might be construed as evidence of noncompliance. So it's like, well, however you read this complaint, there is no liability that can be inferred from it. It's a big, big loss.
Right. And there was just nothing that related to current events as opposed to past semesters.
Right.
So let's look, Joyce. It was a narrow holding, as I read it. And you're our appellate expert. It seemed to me that a narrow holding is more likely to be upheld on appeal than if he had gone broader. What do you think?
So look, if DOJ is smart, I'm not saying that they are, right? Because on Rock Earth One, where DOJ operates the way that we're used to it operating, if DOJ was smart, they would look at this decision and they would say, yeah, we sort of screwed the pooch here in round one. And they would amend their complaint and come back for round two. Because the issue here is that, you know, serious evidence of anti-Semitism at Harvard, and there is evidence here of, as the judge said, episodic incidents, that doesn't necessarily make a legally sufficient case under Title VI. And so really what Judge Stearns is saying to the government is, you have not adequately pleaded what you need to in order to make out a case. Smart lawyers for the government would go back and fix that, because one of the flaws that he identifies here is that the amended complaint lacked factual allegations of any continued violations after Harvard was notified of its noncompliance in 2025. And that makes this complaint really a non-starter here. That is the kind of narrow ruling that could readily be affirmed on appeal. So we'll see. Does DOJ still have it? Or, you know, is there just nobody there who understands what's going on in these cases?
Well, hopefully they're not listening, because if they are, they just got good advice from you. And Barb, I was skeptical about this case to begin with. And there's some evidence that the DOJ, that is Donald Trump and his DOJ, were hostile to Harvard for reasons unrelated to this. Do you have any reason to suspect that hostility to Harvard was really what was behind this case rather than any actual fact?
Oh, I don't know. You mean like Trump's accusations that Harvard was harboring anti-American radicals, or that he withheld grants, that he revoked visas for international students, that he threatened to remove its tax-exempt status, that he pressured Harvard to change its curriculum and end its DEI programs? I think all of those things suggest a hostility from Donald Trump to Harvard. The question is why, right? This is one of America's most prominent and prestigious educational institutions. And I think it's for exactly that reason, right? He wants to silence his critics. Going after universities has always been an authoritarian move, because those are centers of power. And it's also a show of force against elites, right? If he can make them bow in the same way he went after the biggest, most powerful law firms and the biggest media outlets, if he can make them bow, it makes everybody else say, wow, if Harvard had to cave, then what are we going to do? And so I think that's a big part of it. You know, in a prior case, similar to this one, another case against Harvard, a judge said, you know, anti-Semitism is a terrible thing, and nobody wants to continue it. We certainly think that it should be stopped, and enforcement of anti-Semitic harassment is important. But that judge said that it was a smokescreen, that certainly there is some going on, but Trump was conveniently using it because it's very difficult to defend anti-Semitism. And so that smokescreen was an effort to take down this powerful institution of higher learning by making this accusation that's very difficult to defend.
Kim, is this case just another case where the judge is justified in denying the Department of Justice presumption of regularity? I mean, we've seen another one, Katie Fang's lawsuit.
Yeah.
No presumption of regularity.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So just as a primer, the presumption of regularity is basically a doctrine that gives the government the benefit of the doubt. So the court assumes that the government followed its rules, acted in good faith, followed its own policy in pursuing some action against someone. And therefore, when they read the facts in a complaint, they do it in light of that benefit of the doubt being granted to the government. Now, that it's not irrebuttable. If there is evidence that counts against that presumption, then the court will not give the government that good faith. And I think, given that these judges have not been living in a silo, that they've seen all of this litigation that shows time after time after time bad faith on the part of the government, where they're or even just shoddiness, shoddy work, shoddy complaints being written that, you know, a first-year law student could do a better job at, that they are giving this a much harder read and not necessarily granting that presumption in these cases. I think in this case, even if you granted the presumption of regularity, this was still a loser, because even if you take everything that the government asserted as totally true, made all inferences in their favor, this is still a loser. So I'm not even sure that was necessary. But this is a if I worked at DOJ, I would be just beside myself, because it makes it that much harder to go before a court and ask for anything if this is the reputation that you're getting as the government's law firm, and if you were representing a government that's shown this kind of disregard for laws and rules and norms, that would make the job seem really hard. I would not like that job.
The internet is still the Wild West, and it's full of stalkers, scammers, and hackers. You know you should protect yourself, but how? It's actually easier than you think. Here's what you do. Go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and enter code SISTERS to get 20% off Delete Me.
Delete Me removes your personal information that's being sold online, which is why you really need to get it. In the age of AI, we're all especially vulnerable to scammers using our personal data that's floating around on the internet against you. Have you ever Googled yourself and found your home address, phone number, or the name of a family member? It's unsettling, and there's a lot worse out there. The good news is Delete Me can help.
Delete Me does all the hard work to wipe your personal information from data broker websites. And you can get an individual plan for a little over $8 per month. Even if you're not a public figure, in the internet age, all of us are potential targets for malicious actors, blackmailers, and worse. Especially if you have kids in your family, Delete Me is a must. Once we got started with them, the peace of mind was such a relief. I trust them to protect me, my sisters, and my loved ones. And I know they can help keep you and your family safe, too.
Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/sisters and use promo code SISTERS at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and enter code SISTERS at checkout. That's www.joindeleteme.com/sisters, code SISTERS. And the link is in our show notes.
Well, now it's time for our favorite part of the show, where we get to answer our listeners' questions. If you've got questions for us, please email them to us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com. You can also tag us on social media. We always try to keep our eyes open. We may answer your questions on social media. We may put them into the script. And as many of y'all have discovered, we now have a second show, Sisters Sidebar, on Wednesdays, which is exclusively us answering your questions. You can send audio files. We love hearing your voices and answering your questions that way. We're adding in additional questions from those that you've sent us. Today, we've got some really interesting questions. I'll dig right in. Jill, first up for you, here's one from Stacy in Central Florida. We sometimes call that Lower Alabama where I live. Stacy writes, I just finished listening to your book, The Watergate Girl, and it got me wondering, did you ever have the opportunity to speak with or interact with Margaret Mitchell during that era? You might need to remind us who Margaret Mitchell is first, Jill.
Well, Margaret Mitchell probably is the author of, Gone with the Wind? Is that who wrote Gone with the Wind? But anyway, I think she means Martha Mitchell, who was the wife of Attorney General John Mitchell. And Martha Mitchell was among the most colorful characters of the Watergate era. She was a Southern belle. but she also was known for making midnight phone calls to press and other people who she shouldn't have been calling. She was also known for having been rustled down by Secret Service agents because she wanted to do some things and they wanted to stop her. And she is also the subject of a, I think it was Netflix feature film about Martha Mitchell. That is so totally inaccurate that I have to say, please don't watch it. And I did get to meet her, not as a witness in the Watergate case, because of course she would have had spousal privilege as the wife of one of our defendants. So we never talked to her. But after Watergate, I did get to meet her at the Counter Gridiron Dinner, which was held to protest the Gridiron Club's refusal to allow female journalists to belong to the club. And it was a carnival kind of thing that press organizations put together, where Dan Rather and I sold kisses and Martha Mitchell sold phone calls. You could pay her to call anyone anywhere in the United States, because she was famous for these phone calls. And so you could pay her to make these phone calls. The Attorney General, former Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, was selling doodles because he was famous for his doodles. So it was a really wonderful event. And it was in that context that I actually got to meet and talk to Martha Mitchell.
Some other day, I want to hear who bought your kisses.
Yes. Well, but I also, maybe I'll add a picture of the doodle that I got from Elliot Richardson, because
just as long as it's not from Donald Trump in your birthday book.
Yeah, right. It's not. It was for female equality. So it has a lot of the female equality signs and a wise owl. But for an extra amount of money, not only did you get the doodle, but you would get him to sign it specifically to you, and you would put on a post-it your name, and he would just sort of sign it. And he looked at mine and looked up and said, "Oh, I know you. I lost my job because of you." So I will always cherish that. And it is hanging over my desk, not this desk, but the desk that's my real, real desk. So I will put that picture on in our show notes.
Well, Kim, there's a question for you from Robert in Canada. Robert asks, in your discussions, there was a reference to a convicted felon not being able to vote. If I've understood this correctly, would this make convicted felon Donald Trump ineligible to vote?
Robert, that is a great question. So the question of whether somebody who has been convicted of a felony, whether they can vote, varies from state to state. It's determined by the law both of the state where the conviction happens and of the state in which the convicted person lives and votes. So in this case, the only way that a New York State conviction could prevent Donald Trump from voting is if he were incarcerated in New York at the time. He is not incarcerated. He's never was incarcerated. So he would have been able to vote if he were still in New York. And as such, in Florida, which recognizes the reciprocal rules of New York, he can vote in Florida. That would vary based on, as I said, different people based on where they live and where they were convicted. But in his case, he is able to vote under the laws of both New York State and Florida.
Barb, our last question today is for you, and it's a banger. I love this question. Who would you nominate for a Supreme Court Hall of Fame? You know, if there is a Mount Rushmore for the Supreme Court, who would you put on it?
Oh. Yeah, this is a question from Eden, and I love it. It is such a great question. I think if I were to go for a Mount Rushmore, the top four, I'd love to hear your take of who I might be missing. But I think you got to put John Marshall on. He was the Chief Justice who wrote the Marbury versus Madison case that created, or at least recognized, the concept that courts conduct judicial review. It's the job of the courts to say what the law is. I think that's really fundamental. Gotta go with a little Oliver Wendell Holmes in there. You know, he was on the court for a long time. He was famous for a lot of things, including this idea that the marketplace of ideas means we need free speech so that the best ideas can rise to the top. I've always been fond of Frank Murphy, who's from Michigan. He was the attorney general. He was the governor of Michigan. He had a lot of different posts, but mostly because he wrote the dissent in the Korematsu case.
Yes.
You know, that's the one where Japanese Americans were detained during World War II, and most of the Supreme Court kind of went along with it as a matter of national security. And Frank Murphy wrote, like, what are you talking about? This is horrific. And then I really like Robert Jackson. He was the justice who, get this, takes a leave of absence after World War II to be the prosecutor at Nuremberg. He was also the attorney general who gave the great speech in the Great Hall at the Justice Department called the Federal Prosecutor, where he talked about the important ethical obligations of a prosecutor. But one of his quotes from a case that I think is so beautiful. I've quoted it in my own book. It's if there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion. So I think he continues to be relevant. But how about you folks? You have other people you'd put on your Mount Rushmore of Supreme Court justices?
You know, Barb, if I could get you just to carve a little bit smaller and make one room for more, I would add in Thurgood Marshall. And I would include yes. Justice Marshall for his work before he got on the court, when he was a fierce advocate for civil rights, as well as, you know, he spent 24 years on the bench forcing the court to think about people at the margins of society. So forcing the court to think about voting rights, forcing the court to think about criminal defendants, forcing the court to think about who got access to justice. There are so many great Supreme Court justices. I think we could do this forever, but I would definitely add Thurgood Marshall. Jill, what about you?
So I agree with all of the above, and I would add Justice Douglas, and I would add Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who, of course, was the first woman on the court. And I would add, of course, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I would also add Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Kagan and Justice Jackson. Douglas is maybe less well known. Oh, and Justice Brandeis. I'm sorry, forgot to
Absolutely.
Mention Justice
this
Brandeis.
This is getting to be a very large Mount Rushmore.
Because we need that. We really do. And these are all worthy of being there, I would say. Douglas is maybe less well known, but was a great environmentalist, among other things, and deserves our accolades just for that part of his life. There are a lot of really good ones to be included.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, Kim had to leave us, but she wanted to chime in that she would also add Justice John Marshall Harlan, who wrote the sole dissent in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yes.
Remember, that's the case that says separate but equal and lasts for like 100 years until Brown versus the Board of Education reverses it. So he was ahead of his time.
Isn't it amazing that in both that case and in Korematsu, even though the court just, you know, had lost its mind from my point of view, there was one justice who was willing to stand up for what's right. And so in many ways, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg used to say, dissents are written with an eye to the future. In both of those cases, justice was a long time coming, but we ultimately got there because one justice was able to see the path forward. That's maybe the most encouraging thing that we can say today about the moment we live in, where we often have three, sometimes even four justices who recognize that this rule of law stuff really matters.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Kimberly Atkins Store, Jill Winebanks, and me, Joyce Vance. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate the show, send it to a friend, and be sure to follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen. That way you'll never miss an episode. Join us every Saturday as we break down the biggest legal developments of the week, and then tune in again on Wednesdays for our new Hashtag Sisters-in-Law Sidebar podcast, where we take your questions. You can shop for Sisters-in-Law merch. We've got some great tote bags and t-shirts right now in our shop. You'll find that at Sisters-in-Law at politicon.com.
And make sure you follow us on Instagram, where we're trying to post our videos so you can see them at sistersinlaw.podcast. Check out the special offers in this episode from our sponsors. We have great ones this week: HomeServe, WildGrain, Honeylove, and DeleteMe. We'll see you next week. Hashtag sistersinlaw.
Hardwired. The Kimberly Atkins Store story.
Yeah, that's right. Kim's autobiography, and we all get to contribute.